This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If you've noticed the huddles of smokers outside office buildings shrinking, you're onto something. A new study finds that smoking in the United States is down sharply, down more than 4% just last year, down to 1951 in terms of numbers of cigarettes sold, down to 1930s levels in cigarettes per capita. After the tobacco settlement in 1998, money poured into public education campaigns. Aggressive anti-smoking advertisements replaced Joe Camel. But are public service ads really responsible? It could be simple economics. The price of a pack of smokes hovers around $5 or $6. It could be the availability of nicotine patches and gum. It could be the public humiliation involved in being forced to step outside to fire up. Later on in the program, Ron Elving will join us with an update on the Dubai World Ports controversy and Washington, D.C.'s addiction to the BlackBerry. One-time wonkette Anna Marie Cox will join us. But first, what's behind the decline in cigarette smoking? If you quit, what was your tipping point? Why do you think the numbers are changing? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is talk@npr.org. And we begin with Greg Connolly, who teaches the prevention and control of tobacco-related diseases as professor of the practice of public health at the Harvard School of Public Health. And he's with us today from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And Professor Connolly, let me ask you, as you look at these numbers, do you think that a tipping point of sorts has been reached?
Well, I think it has, but it has among, you know, well-to-do Americans who wear ties. I think the tragedy is, if we look at these numbers, even though we're down 20% in sales, of all the Americans alive today, 12 million are going to die from cigarette smoking in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. What we have done is we have, you know, gone after tobacco, but seen the tobacco industry only target high-risk groups, people who are poor, low income. And unfortunately, I think we're seeing the states, because all the money they're receiving from big tobacco in this settlement, take that money and use it for purposes other than tobacco control.
And
we're making progress.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm asking you about and the reasons behind the progress. Yes, of course, we know that tobacco remains the most preventable source of disease in the country. But why do you think those numbers are turning around?
Okay. Well, I think a couple of things. One, we can ascribe one-third of the decline to price increases. So price increases do work. 33% of the decline is associated with increasing price. But two-thirds of the decline is associated with state campaigns making it unacceptable to smoke in public places, protecting the health of restaurant and bar workers. That's been critically important. And also, some states, not every state, but some states have been allocating their money for aggressive campaigns showing the harmful effects of tobacco use on television, making sure kids don't buy cigarettes illegally, working with their doctors and healthcare providers to counsel patients. So one third is due to price, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But price works with all these other measures to make sure people aren't smoking. So it is working, but I just want to caution everyone in America today, but it's working, but it's probably not working as well with low-end people in America. And companies like Philip Morris and RJ Reynolds, you know, they're probably saying, we're going to give away those people who would quit otherwise, but we want that core of people who are not thinking about quitting.
You used an interesting word in your answer, unacceptable to smoke in office buildings and restaurants and bars in a lot of places. Unacceptable is the interesting part. It's illegal to smoke in most of those places these days. Unacceptable is sort of the social stigma that is attached once you're forced to become a pariah of sorts.
Well, that's not true because, you know, the people who get harmed today from smoking in public places are restaurant and bar workers, and they have some of the highest lung cancer rates of any occupation group. We don't make nurses go in and smoke in operating rooms. We don't make teachers smoke in school rooms. We don't make flight attendants smoke in airlines.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, today, because we're saying we're trying to afford restaurant and bar workers a clean environment, that's not a stigma. That's only giving them the right that
well,
they
I was
deserve.
Sort of turning it on the other side, that people who feel like they who have to step outside to smoke might say, I feel like a pariah, therefore maybe I'll quit smoking.
Well, you know, a pretty good way to help people quit smoking, you know, is to say that you can't smoke at home. And through public education campaigns, you don't want to expose your child to the dangers of secondhand smoke. And the data is very, very clear that secondhand smoke is going to increase the risk of asthma attack among a child.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make sure that those workplaces are smoke-free. So if you do that, it's almost like giving someone a nicotine patch or giving them, you know, counseling. It's sort of a social strategy to let people smoke. Now, let me just say, everyone wants to quit smoking who smokes. I don't care if you're in Beijing, Berlin, Boston. 50% of smokers are making one serious quit attempt in any one given year. They're stopping for 24 hours, and that's really a serious quit attempt. But the problem is, if that smoker who quits goes into a bar where this beautiful woman comes up to him and says, hey, you know, let's start smoking again, and here, I'm going to give you the cigarette. You get someone who relapses. You know, and in the old days, what we did, because we didn't change social norms, you know, we were sort of seeing people quit. They would go then and use nicotine replacement therapy the drug companies gave them, and then be back smoking again. So I think America, I think our success, you know, has been in changing social norms. I just got back from the Middle East. I did a training on behalf of Harvard with 18 Middle Eastern countries, Jordan, Iraq, Syria. And smoking is so prevalent there. And I think one of the tragedies is, and there was a health minister in Iraq from the Basra area saying, you know, our people are being killed in Iraq for terrorist issues, but we're losing so many, many more people from smoking. And what can you do as Americans to help us? All you're doing is dumping the cigarettes that you don't want in Washington or Chicago or San Francisco in that part of the world. It was a very tragic thing to see.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. If you've quit or you're trying to quit, what was your tipping point? Why do you think the numbers of smokers are down so remarkably? Again, let's start with Martha. Martha's calling us from Portland in Oregon.
Hi.
Hey, Martha.
Hello. I recently quit smoking 4 months ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I would say, as far as the reason why numbers have gone down, I would say prevention, as far as advertising campaigns aimed at kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally quit because I knew that I could use a patch, and it actually helped me a lot.
Uh-huh. A lot of people say that, Greg Connolly. The patch is it really works for a lot of people.
Absolutely. You know, when people quit smoking, they go in through withdrawal. So their nerves, their body is looking for nicotine. The patch or the gum relieves those symptoms. And the first 2 weeks are the toughest. And if you have that patch, you're giving those nerve endings the nicotine replacement therapy so you can get through those really tough weeks. After that, it's more behavioral. It's more dealing with those situations that want you to smoke. Going to a bar, having a drink with a friend, having a craving. But, you know, patch and gum work. You know, in terms of the advertising, in Massachusetts, we ran very aggressive advertising showing real people, real stories about people who died from smoking that, you know, in a sense, showed the person who smoked Marlboros, who said, well, you know, I smoke Marlboros. I'm like the Marlboro man. I've never seen a Marlboro man who died from smoking. They're all healthy. They're all macho. And I'm immune. I'm not going to die because I smoke Marlboros. So we showed the Marlboro man. We actually put a Marlboro man on TV who was dying from lung cancer and broke down those barriers and communicated personal risk. It was like reality TV at its best, and it worked. We did a survey of 700 farmer smokers. One of the main reasons why they said they quit smoking is because they saw aggressive television advertising about the dangers of smoking.
And Martha's point about children and the restriction of, well, I guess the loss of Joe Camel is how everybody summarizes it. As you look at these numbers, slightly higher numbers of, I guess, teenagers smoke than the numbers of adults these days still.
Well, you know, our big problem is we saw a big surge in youth smoking in the early 1990s, and these kids are like the egg going through, you know, the snake. these kids now are going into college, they're going to young adulthood, and they're smoking in high numbers because they started earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's never happened before, but the highest smoking rates in our nation now are among people between 18 and 25. We have a battle right now with big tobacco because many of these kids only smoke on weekends when they go out, you know, to a club or a bar. And big tobacco wants to see them become daily smokers. We want to see them quit. So that's our fight right now. And despite the decline, we have a problem here that we all have to be very, very cognizant of.
Martha, thanks very much. And hang in there, okay? let's turn to Matt. And Matt's with us from Hatfield, Wisconsin.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Matt.
My reason for quitting, and I'm, well, I started the a pack after my last pack, last pack forever. And so I'm right on the cusp of quitting here. But my reason for smoking, I guess, is really peer pressure to quit. The fact that nobody does, I still date. So when you look for people, most don't. So
a big attraction in the old days was this idea that smoking was somehow cool. And I think, Matt, you're telling us it's not so cool anymore.
It's absolutely the opposite.
And that seems to me, we just have a few seconds before the break, Greg Connolly, but that seems to me to be a big change.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, the tobacco industry has been doing big sponsorships of bars and clubs where they have Marlboro Nights and Camel Nights. In a sense, you know, for that young cohort, that young crowd, they're trying to make it cool and hip. You know, and that's why, you know, when you prohibit smoking in public places, New York City, Washington's going to go smoke-free, San Francisco, Boston. You know, you're denying the tobacco industry the nicotine classroom. They want to use the bar and the club to make it the nicotine classroom for the next generation, and they don't deserve it, nor do the lungs of the young people in America.
Matt, good luck to you.
Thank you kindly.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more of your calls on why you think the numbers of smokers are down in the United States, down to historic levels. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about a new study which finds a remarkable drop in the number of people who smoke in this country. The study shows a more than 4% fall since 2005 and more than 20% since tobacco companies reached a legal settlement with the states back in 1998. Our guest is Greg Connolly, professor of the practice of public health at Harvard's School of Public Health. And, of course, you're invited to join the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And here's an email question from Teresa in Elkhart, Indiana. Sure, the numbers look good in 2006, but I have an additional question. Has the number of teens that smokes decreased as well? I think we were just talking about that. If the kids are quitting and or not starting, then we can clash the festive symbols.
Well, I mean, this is Greg Connolly from Harvard School of Public Health. The number of younger teens has declined. The number of young adults, though, is increasing, and it's alarming. We have to be concerned. We're battling with the tobacco industry for that 18 through 24-year-old card. It's hip still to smoke. And I think one of the disturbing things is if you look at a Hollywood film, there is an over-presentation of tobacco use there, clearly targeting young people. We have done research also looking at tobacco products, and we're seeing cigarette companies such as R.J. Reynolds introducing highly flavored cigarettes, cigarettes with candy-like flavors, you know, to really turn a blowtorch into rice pudding. So we haven't won the war here, and that's what I want to express. If we look at all the children alive in America today, over our lifetime, over the next 30 years, given current rates, 1.5 million will be killed by cigarette smoking. Even despite the 20% decline that we've seen. We've seen a decline, probably with the people wearing ties. Only we've seen big tobacco get smarter and target those people who are poor, who are disadvantaged. And I think we've got to wake up to that. So we're not claiming victory here. We've made success, but we really got to think about the long term. A few years ago, 2 years ago, the Congress considered legislation to regulate tobacco products as drugs. Maybe we should do that. Maybe we should thinking about in our lifetime, over the next 30 years, that you know, the conventional cigarette as we know it is treated like lard. It's not made available to the American public, or if it is, it's highly priced and it's, you know, back on the counter. And we have other mechanisms for giving people nicotine so they're not highly dependent upon the tobacco product. I think we have to be very, very concerned in that Big Tobacco has given the state hundreds of billions of dollars to settle the suit. In a sense, the states now potentially are binding themselves with Big Tobacco to assure they get revenue to pay for things other than quitting smoking or preventing children from smoking, for paying for roads and for pension funds. And that can be a disaster, a public health disaster for our nation. And I think if you look at the settlement payments given to the state, only a fraction of those dollars are being given for prevention programs with youth or providing smokers with help to quit. And I think the states have to take a very, very serious look and ask a big question. When they sued Big Tobacco and when they went to court and they raised their hand and they said to the judges, we sued for the children. We're here to prevent the children from smoking. Mm-hmm. But just a few years later, they're turning around and saying, no, we didn't do that. We just sued for the money. And we're going to use that money any way we please.
Let's get another listener in on the conversation. Now, this is Rock, and Rock's calling us from Payson, Arizona.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
I was just calling in. I really, what I think is that the percentages are probably down because of the boomers. We're such a huge percentage of the population, and as you get more mature, you realize that you're immortal. And I think that it causes us to want to take better care of ourselves.
I think you misspoke, Rock. As you get older, you become perhaps more mature, though. I guess that's a debatable point.
Well, yes. Out here in Payson, where I live, I swear to God, 80% of the people out here smoke.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's very, very high, and I don't know why it is. I really think it probably has to do somewhat with amount of education that you have.
Are the local regulations, do they allow smoking in restaurants and bars, that sort of thing?
Believe it or not, they still have smoking sections here.
I guess that's increasingly. Let me ask Greg Connolly. Is that from my point of view, it seems unusual, but is it more usual than not?
Well, 8 states have banned smoking in restaurants and bars in all public places. It's about 35% of the national population. This year, we're going to see legislation or ballot questions move in Hawaii, New Mexico, Colorado, and other areas. So for the majority of this country, no. I mean, you know what's really interesting is if you go to Kentucky, you have lung cancer rates probably higher than you'd see in Poland. Yet you go to California, you see lung cancer rates that are extremely low. So it's really changing the social norms. It's making tobacco use on a social basis not acceptable, and then loving the smoker, helping the smoker to quit.
Rock, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Carrie in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm a college student that quit smoking a year and a half ago. The reason? I moved to New York City. Trying to afford New York rent was hard enough without throwing $89 a day away. Also, you couldn't smoke even in bars anymore, and it was far too cold to go outside. It just wasn't worth it anymore. I ended up leaving New York, but I still don't smoke. I'm really grateful to New York City. Otherwise, I still might be damaging my lungs every day. We're not going to talk about the amount of ash that might have been in the air, but anyway.
You know, I think one has to say Mayor Bloomberg is probably one of the biggest public health leaders in our nation. He banned smoking in all workplaces in New York, including, you know, pubs and restaurants, and he raised the price. And he's made that city so, so healthy. And then Tom Friedman, who's the health commissioner of New York, has, you know, been working with him. And it's just, if you look at New York, it's a public health miracle.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jeff, and Jeff's with us from Tucson, Arizona. Jeff? Jeff's listening and not realizing that we're broadcasting a little bit on delay, so he's actually not listening to his phone right now. He's listening to the radio. Jeff, one more time. Too bad, Jeff. Let's go to Kathy. Kathy from Arlington, Virginia.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm really glad that this subject has come up because every time I see a smoker, I want to tell them how I quit. And I quit because I heard a lady say to me that the same way that you can have self-control, the same way that you pick up a cigarette, you can control yourself to not pick up a cigarette. The same way that you have a habit, you can turn that habit into a good habit. If you want to smoke, you can substitute it with working out, or you can substitute it as going for a walk, or do something else that's healthy for you as opposed to smoking. And also, after smoking, I realized that smoking shows the public or shows people around you that you have a weakness. And in essence, you're really showing the negative side of you. So hopefully that will put some things into perspective. I've touched a cigarette for 10 years.
Well, congratulations, Kathy. But Greg Connolly, some people find discipline, it's a really hard habit to break.
Well, I think the best thing to do is choose a quit date. And it could be a month from now or 2 months from now. Before you quit day, try to taper down. You know, try to smoke fewer cigarettes per day. Identify those triggers, those things that make you want to smoke. Having a cup of coffee, going out with friends. And then think about something else to do. Drink a lot of water. Do some exercise. So you need a plan. You can put this all on a smoking plan, and it does work. We know that. And then if you're, you know, a heavy smoker smoking more than 10 cigarettes per day, you want to use nicotine replacement therapy. You want a patch and you want gum. The patch gives you a background dose of nicotine, so it gets you through those withdrawal symptoms. You don't have the cravings. And then the gum, you can take the gum, and that helps when those cravings get really intense. So you can do it. If you do those measures, you're going to increase the ability to quit almost twofold, two times. So you can do it, and Kathy just described how you can do it.
Okay, Kathy. Continued good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Here's a question we got from Sarah in Atlanta, Georgia. Your guest implied that lower-income people are less responsive to increases in cigarette prices than are higher-income people. I just did a quick web search. I didn't find anything like that to be largely true. Is there a study you can point us to? I'm just curious.
I didn't say price increases contributed to a disproportionate rate of quitting. What I did say is we're seeing people who are of low income are smoking at higher rates than people of higher income. That's what I said. Mm-hmm. And there is ample studies to show that. And what I would reinforce, as we're making
success... Well, the implication of that is that they're less resistant to price increases than other people.
I didn't say that. What I said is that smoking rates still remain high among low-income purses versus high-income purses. And it's not probably due to price. It's probably due just to factors associated with nicotine dependence. I think what I'm arguing here is the states have to take the money they got from big tobacco through the settlement and put it into programs that target persons of color. They have to put the money back into communities where we see high smoking rates. And that's not being done universally in our country. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a tragedy. The other thing I would point out is as we quit smoking in America, companies like Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds, are only going into China, Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and finding replacement smokers.
And we'll have more on that in just a minute. But I did want to ask this other email question we got from Jesse. This reflects several calls and emails we've gotten. Don't you think that barring smoking in all public places deprives intelligent, informed Americans their freedom to make their own choice? Shouldn't it be the responsibility of the bar and restaurant owners to establish their own smoking policies based on their customers' requests? Are non-smokers' rights the only ones that are important?
No, no one has a right to admit 4,000 chemicals, 42 of which are known to be carcinogens, into a closed indoor environment. No one has a right to pollute the air I breathe. It doesn't make sense. We don't make, NPR news spokesmen like yourself sit in a room with people smoking, and if you don't like it, tell you, well, go quit. Mm-hmm. You can just quit NPR, and if you don't like people smoking, we don't do that. We assure clean indoor air in any environment, and no one has a right to pollute that environment. And again, one of the highest rates of lung cancer we see among restaurant and bar workers in our nation. And I've been to city council hearings, New York, Boston, elsewhere in the country, and I think some of the most compelling witnesses is when you hear a restaurant worker get up and say, before the city council in New York, I'm a single mom. I don't have health insurance. I can't quit my job. I come home at night and I have sinusitis, and my clothes stink, my hair stinks, And you and the city council in New York, if someone told you you had to go through with this, you'd be outraged.
Mm.
That's my life.
Interesting case in the state of New Jersey, which just passed a smoking ban, except for casinos. And it's interesting that both other restaurant owners have said, why should casinos be exempted? If they're getting an exemption, why shouldn't we? And they're also being appealed by workers in casinos as to why should we, among all the workers in the states, be second-class citizens. So I'll be interested to see how that works out. Greg Connolly, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very, very much for having me on board.
Greg Connolly, a professor of public health practice at Harvard School of Public Health, and he joined us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. For the record, we called R.J. Reynolds and Philip Morris to comment on the public smoking campaigns. No one was available to talk to us today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. While smoking is on the decline in the U.S., that's not the case in other parts of the world. Matthew Corman is a professor of cultural and social anthropology at Stanford University who studied smoking in China, and he joins us now from the studios at Stanford. Good of you to take the time to be with us today.
Hi there, Neil.
So is smoking on the increase in China? And if it is it throughout the population or in some segments?
Smoking is definitely on the rise across China. China today boasts, sadly enough, 360 million smokers. That's a quarter of the world's smoking population, and it's been going up. It's going up at a significant pace just a decade ago. These numbers are so large, they're hard to even fathom at sometimes. A decade ago, China had 320 million smokers. Now, most recent reports are showing 360 million smokers. That's a very significant rise.
Is there any anti-smoking campaign by the government in China?
Yes, there is. The Chinese government, like governments around the world, is quite torn about what to do with tobacco. It depends on tobacco taxes, like many countries in the world, but it's not a monolith, despite what many commentators in the United States and other parts of the world think of the Chinese government. It's not a monolith, and there are segments of the government that are working quite vociferously to squelch smoking across the country. Unfortunately, they're not strong enough, and they need all the support they can get. There are quite a bit of no smoking signage you find in cities across China. Regrettably, a lot of it is not followed. It's flouted. People don't pay attention to it. So, follow up is vital. But you do see significant efforts. I wish it was more dramatic, but there is efforts underway.
On the other hand, is smoking portrayed as cool in Chinese media? I mean, the equivalent of Bette Davis and Paul Hanreid and now Voyager, is that going on in Chinese TV and cinema?
You bet. I mean, smoking is quite prolific in Chinese cinema. You see it in movies. You see it in TV a fair amount. You see it in bars, you see it in discotheques. There's definitely a cool phenomenon, and the term "cool" is now been transliterated into Chinese, and it's cool. Or more recently, I've heard it's now "ko." It's a term that has a lot of the smackings of cool in the United States, including the cigarette, unfortunately.
I understand that you have written a handbook on how to give up smoking in Chinese.
That's right. With some colleagues of mine in Southwest China, in the Kunming Medical College, we've just released in Beijing through mainland Chinese press one of the first smoking cessation manuals published in China. And it's just come out, and we're going to start to explore how useful it is.
And I understand there's also a big gender disparity in China, that many more men smoke than women.
Oh, yes. And this is one of the more interesting features of smoking in China. About 60% of men over age 15 smoke, while only about 3-4% of women smoke. So it's a dramatic, dramatic disparity. So about two-thirds of men smoke and only a small fraction of women smoke. And I've been trying to understand this for a number of years.
Now, the numbers in this country used to be not dissimilar, 80 years ago.
Right, right. And one would have expected that in the last few years, rates among women would have gone up. In fact, what we've been seeing is overall rates among women have been declining to some degree. I think that has there's a couple of reasons to that, and I'd be happy to discuss that.
Well, maybe on another day, but we're right up against the break. Matthew Korman, okay. Good luck with the handbook.
Thank you very much, and good luck.
Matthew Korman, professor of cultural and social anthropology at Stanford, and joined us from the studios at Stanford University. When we come back from a break, we're going to be talking with NPR Washington editor Ron Elving about news on the Dubai World Ports deal. The company may be withdrawing its application to take over those ports in six American cities. We'll find out more and find out whether it'll fly with Congress. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.